This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Gentlemen, please welcome in conversation with Julia Wheeler, Simon Reeve.
Fighting our way out.
Thank you.
Hello. Hello. Hello.
Hello and welcome to the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival. Thank you very much for being here. Thanks to those at the back that are standing three, four,
and
five
sitting,
deep.
Yeah.
Can you hear us all right? Great.
Yes.
Okay, put your hands up if it changes. So
complain, basically.
Complain,
yeah.
Complain. They don't come much better travelled than this man. He's been now to 120 countries around the world as an adventurer, a writer and a maker of programmes for the BBC. And one thing that I think runs through all of that work is the travel with the issues that he explores. So you've got environmental issues, you've got political turmoil, you've got war zones, you've got people doing good and not so good. Runs through it all. And in the last year, he's been making programmes in the Arctic and in Turkey, and also The Big Life Fix, which some of you may well have seen on the BBC as well. So let's start with Turkey, because you've sort of hot-footed it back from there not so long ago. hugely rich and diverse country.
Yeah.
You've got a failed coup in the last little while. It's always in the news. You've got war zone on the southern border and so on.
Oh,
how
true.
Do you even start to tackle a programme about the whole of Turkey?
Very fair question. Thank you for this. Hello, everybody. Hello. Sorry if I've got my back to you, so do tell me off and I was going to say I'll swivel, but that could be misinterpreted. But how do you start? I think, in truth, we all went, oh, my goodness, how are we going to fit this into two TV programmes? It's offensive in some ways, the how TV works, where we have 2 hours of television to try and in some tiny way tell the story of a country, and a complicated country as well. It's ludicrous, of course it is, but you have a bit of a panic, first of all. Then you work out what's possible and viable in terms of a journey, and you work out what stories we can tell along the way. It's a slight chicken and egg situation in that a strong character, if we find a strong character who we know will make good telly, then they probably get more points than a strong view. But every element is weighted in some way. How long will it take us to get there? Where will we stay? How long will it take us to leave and get to the next story? How much is it going to cost? You know, it's the BBC. We haven't got squillions to waste, thank goodness. Or disappointingly, depending on your point of view. So lots of considerations. The main thing, I suppose, is how can we turn it into a, as you allude to there, how can we turn it into a real adventure, but one that incorporates lots of issues as well? Because I'm not to claim that it's a hallmark of my journey, because I've done lots of different types of things, I suppose, but what I have tried to do is incorporate strong stories with a real journey. And for me, that's what's most interesting about travel, when your every sense is being tweaked and teased. So when your experience is rich and rewarding, sometimes because it's frightening, sometimes because it's emotional, sometimes because it's just awe-inspiring, but I want to have a proper experience. I don't just want to go somewhere bland and eat, you know, club sandwich, for God's sake. You know, life is too short.
So how much do you plan before you go, and how much of what we see in TV is actually luck and circumstance when you're there?
Yeah, it's hard to sort of pin down, I suppose. We've never been through it with a stopwatch.
Now, what's
been through
your
the programs.
Now,
my sense would be we don't have a script for a start. And that's
that,
quite
that
unusual.
That never shows.
That we don't have a script. I'm going to take that in a positive way. So that does mean we freestyle, we make it up as we go along, depends how you want to call it. But most TV does have scripts, so even stuff that looks relatively spontaneous, probably somebody's been ahead, worked out where to put the tripod, etc. We don't do that, partly because we haven't got the money for the recce, but partly because doing it naturally, it just leads to a more interesting bit of telly, hopefully, a more interesting experience. But we do plan and prep in advance. It would be madness for us to turn up in Turkey or Colombia, where I've just been filming, without us having made some preparation. So how much time? Probably 3 months before we start filming. We're looking into it. We're still having a couple of biscuits while we're doing it. We're doing it calmly. 2 months, it's getting a little bit tenser. You know, we really need to start making some plans, guys. When it's a month to go, as it is for another trip I'm doing now, now people are saying, for goodness sake, we really need to book some flights and have some concrete plans in place. But if we change our minds right up to the moment and while we're there, then what's been wonderful for me about the teams I've been working with making most of these programs is if there's a solid justification, we will go with it. Whatever we've got planned, if we see something important, more interesting, more beautiful on the other side of the mountain range, valley, whatever, we've got the freedom to go and look at that. So we're not tied to a schedule completely, but we do prep. It would be mad. We'd be wasting your money if we didn't.
So Michael Palin was here the other day, and he was saying how he
must
had
automatically doff cap
good,
at
excellent.
The name. It's a sort of response, Pavlovian. Yeah.
And he was saying how he has had the same cameraman, or he had the same cameraman for 25 years.
Yeah.
On his journeys. Do you find that you are able to get a crew around you and keep them, or is that something that's imposed from above?
Yeah, I think it's just testimony to how lovely he is, because I couldn't get anyone to work with me for that long. I think there's pros and cons to that sort of relationship. I have generally worked with mainly two cameramen for Craig and Jonathan, and if there's anyone I should be doffing my cap for, it's them, because they have by far the hardest gig on the programs I do. It's exhausting. Now, my mum actually says this, she reminds me regularly of this line from, I think it was Ginger Rogers, who said, I do everything that Fred Astaire does, but going backwards and in high heels. Yes, few people know the line. And I trot it out with Craig and Jonathan as a sort of means of trying to remind them that I do understand. They've got 14 kilos on the shoulder. They're trying to keep me in focus as I'm gabbing away, and they're walking backwards on a stony, broken path, and they fall over, they take a tumble. A lot of people won't put up with that because it's hard work, and we're asking them to make professional compromises to actually do that. But they do it because they like the journeys and they like the sort of raw appeal of it, I suppose. You'd have to ask them, I guess. They are paid to do it, after all. And I do wash their underpants occasionally and feed them tea and biscuits. So, you know, there's worse gigs in the world, in truth. But, credit to Michael for staying with I've forgotten his name now.
Nigel.
Yeah. Nigel Meakin, I think, is his cameraman. So I've stuck with a couple. I suppose we do slightly different. I've been to slightly tricky places on some of the journeys I've done. And Jonathan Young, doff cap, who's the cameraman, one of the cameramen I work with, he's got an impeccable background in tricky places. So he is my tricky places kind of chap. And he does a lot of work with Ross Kemp, filming on Ross Kemp's series. He's filmed in every war zone, really. He's filmed with John Simpson. He's filmed with lots of people. So he knows his stuff, and he's a good man to be with when things are going right or wrong in a conflict zone. Craig shoots beautifully, but doesn't own a Leatherman.
What's a Leatherman?
What's a Leatherman? We're all travellers here. We all know. Little multi-tool thing. That, like a Swiss Army knife,
yeah,
So we have to sort of remind him to have the bits and pieces for the kit. But he's incredible. He shoots incredibly beautifully. So pros and cons to everybody. That wasn't quite what you were asking. I was going on a little bit of a love fest with Jonathan and Craig, because I adore them.
You're
both.
You're allowed. And you have washed
small
their
team. I work on. I have washed it. I washed, certainly washed Jonathan's more than once. But small teams I work with. So obviously, Michael Palin, he has several different units working with him sometimes. I work with a small team. Four of us generally travel away. It's drawn from a relatively small pool, I would say, of camera folk. And we have a producer-director, we have an assistant producer who does just about everything, and we have a cameraman who carries all of us in many ways. So small team, and it's quite intense, actually. And, not everybody wants to do it or can hack it, because it's moving on almost every day. But it's very rewarding for those who love it, I would say. Is that anything approximating an answer?
It is. And
okay.
I'd like to follow it up with a question about when you leave the room, what do you reckon they say about you? What do you imagine that they say about you in the comparison to you doffing your cap to them?
They'd say I'm very demanding. That's what they say to my face. So goodness knows what they say behind my back. I wouldn't say I push us as a team. I do encourage, let's put it that way. We have to go further. We have to find more extreme situations because that's our gig, really. We've all been to extraordinary places on this planet. For telly, we've got to go a bit further because we're making a TV program. It has to be very visual. We've got to find extraordinary stories. It is very difficult. It's very difficult finding the balance and the basket, if you like, of elements in making a show like the ones I do, because we have extreme suffering in some situations. We have extraordinary beauty. We have eccentric characters. We have glorious situations. We have me eating mad food. It's a really rich, sometimes contradictory mix, and finding those elements and stitching them together is hard. So I'd say they think I'm a pain and demanding, and they wish I'd get up earlier sometimes when I've said, we really got to get these shots. Well, why won't you get up then, Simon? You know, that's part of the issue.
So let's talk
And
about
I insist on stopping for lunch. And when they're really in the flow,
like
they don't
that.
Know. Well, some of them don't, some of them do, some of them don't. I say, we've got to have a plate. You know, I don't want to eat any. I don't want to eat Pringles yet again. This is not a sustainable food.
So let's talk about some of those stories that you stitched together in Turkey. Right. What would you pick out as highlights?
Well, there's one instantly leaping into my head when you say that. So yeah, you said in the intro really about the elements of Turkey that I think we identify now. I mean, when people think of Turkey at the moment, it probably has a more, I would say, negative, darker image right now than it did 3, 2, 5, certainly, years ago. So, yes, it's had a failed coup, political crisis, war in neighbouring Syria. There's a purge underway of anyone deemed to have stood in opposition to the government, and obviously a lot of them did in the failed coup. There's a refugee, I wouldn't say crisis in Turkey, because they have... they are hosting an extraordinary number of Syrian refugees, 2.7 to 3 million, say that again, nearly 3 million refugees are finding sanctuary in Turkey. So Turkey's doing more than any other country, and it's actually built what I would say, and others have said, are the most extraordinary refugee camps in the world to host tens of thousands of them. So, but all of these elements are wrapped up in the story of Turkey, along with the history, along with faith, along with ethnic questions, Kurdish question, but other ethnic groups there as well, wrapped all up together in a huge country, population of 80 million, tried to do it in two programmes. Obviously, that's quite tricky. And the one that stands out is being in the Black Sea Mountains. Who's been to the Black Sea Mountains? Anybody? That is an extraordinary... Maybe there's a hand wobbling, but Brits are too nervous. But there's not the hands you would expect if I said, you know, who's been to, see the pyramids in Egypt or something else that's similarly exotic. The Black Sea Mountains in Turkey are absolutely stunning. Like, I would say, the Canadian Rockies, but with a more interesting variety of trees. Huge mountains covered in forest, and to my great pleasure and enjoyment, lots of interesting, feisty characters as well. So we went to see a guy called Metin there, who's got a bed and breakfast that I would encourage you all to go and stay at.
All at once.
Very fair point. But you can see his mobile number in the programme. I'm not sure if we should blur it so he doesn't get deluged. But anyway, Metin lives on... His B&B is on one side of a valley, and the road takes you up and stops on the other side of the valley. How then do we get from the one side to the other? You take a half kilometre long zip wire, a homemade zip wire, across a valley that is 400 metres deep beneath you, and you travel clinging to the side, well, I certainly did anyway, of a cart that was designed to hold the weight of a cow. So felt pretty confident it should be able to hold me in a couple of bags. But, you know, this wasn't entirely stress tested before we did it. But Metin was such a wonderful, warm, very calm character as well. And he had a really lovely story about how he's very anti our global culture of building a road to everything. Road, 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 right? There's a beautiful forest, let's build a road through it. Well, his point was that this was a sort of alternative way of him getting to his home without constructing a road. And roads are a big issue in Turkey because a benefit to many, but obviously many others think that it's destroying parts of the countryside. So we raised that issue. Metin talked to us about that. He's got an enormous Kangol dog, which is a sort of Turkish shepherd dog that is like, well, it's bred to fight bears, so you can probably imagine the size of it. And in that area, I've got another one as well, Charm, who's one of Turkey's greatest environmentalists, conservationists. He took us out looking for brown bears in the Black Sea Mountains and that area into the east of Turkey. They have bears and wolves and lynx in Turkey. It is actually one of the most biodiverse parts of our planet, as well as being oldest civilization, most biodiverse. Lots of climactic zones collide and coincide there, the Mediterranean, Eurasian, Caucasian, etc. So incredible biodiversity. It's really a part of Turkey I knew nothing about. So those would be two characters, but so many different, now you've said it, oh, I'm getting this explosion in my head of moments.
Okay, well, let me pick one then. How about the whirling dervishes?
Whirling dervishes, yes.
And can you do us a demo?
No, I just said to you, I just mentioned I will never dance. You're just trying to get me going on that.
Do we want him
to
do a whirling dervish?
No. That's going to end very nastily for everybody, and particularly people in the front row as I fall on them. We haven't risk assessed this. Whirling dervishes. Okay, so they're almost a bit of they're a slight Turkish cliche, I would say, but they represent an aspect of faith in Turkey that we really wanted to incorporate in. I'm probably going to go quite slowly with what I'm saying here because I haven't really formulated this thought properly. I haven't written the script for this bit. That's my weekend job, in fact. But we went to Konya. Has anyone been to Konya? It's the most... A couple of hands going up. Did you go to Rumi's shrine in Konya? So it's the shrine of the great poet Mevlana Rumi, who's still... not just a hero, but a sort of guiding light to many Turks and many people of Sufi faith and throughout the Islamic world. And the reason for us doing that was really, I suppose, to try and highlight the slightly different characteristics of faith in Turkey compared to faith in Saudi Arabia, for example. And Turkey is a politically hugely controversial country, of course. It has always been at the crossroads between East and West, the meeting point, etc., and every other cliche. But a lot of the cliches are true, for goodness sake. It is where the Middle East and Europe meet. And for so long, people have been saying to Turkey, you've got to choose one or the other. You've even got to choose, are you a European country or are you an Eastern country? What are you? And I think trying to understand what Turkey is. We went to Konya and we also went to meet the sort of religious affairs directorate in Ankara and asked them. And the sense I have is that Turkey's choosing its own path and it's going to do something slightly different to what everybody's been saying it has to. It's strong, it's powerful, it's influential, it's becoming a bit of a beacon in the Islamic world. So it matters now more than ever. It's arguably the most important country in the world. I think I could put a strong case forward for that, geographically, geopolitically, geostrategically, etc. But when it comes to faith and religion as well, very, very important. So it was a really critical time to be there, an exciting time, but it's a hell of a responsibility as well. I would really question, I'm going to question myself about whether we get it right, frankly.
In direct contrast, if you like, to Turkey, you've also this year been off to the Arctic.
Yeah.
And Arctic Live. Now, live TV, that's a different kettle of fish altogether. Had you ever done that before?
Not really. I mean, I've done chats on live TV, things like going on BBC Breakfast and things like that, which is, it's okay. They're very lovely there. They give you a cup of tea and they're quite warm before. Doing live TV from Churchill in Northern Canada. Who's been to Churchill? Come on, this is such a... Yeah, there's more of you than that, I would have thought. No? Churchill in Northern Canada. So this is the polar bear capital of the world. So polar bears migrate through Churchill on their way out onto Hudson Bay as the ice freezes over, although not surprising that's happening later than ever now as we ruin our planet. But the bears head out to hunt seals on the ice and they pass through this town that humans have somewhat foolishly built in their path. And so Sarah Gibbs, I'm naming her and praising and shaming her, it was her idea that the BBC transport two very good TV presenters and myself myself, Gordon Buchanan and Kate Humble, and me, who'd never done live TV, to Churchill to broadcast live, hopefully as the Bears arrive, and make a bit of a telly show about it. And we did, and, you know, it sort of worked, actually, I am relieved to say. Live TV, flipping heck. So you're looking, you've got a camera, you know, right here, and you've got a soothing Scottish voice in your ear counting down. It's minus 20. I'm working with a professional team who've done this before. I am definitely the Muppet who has never done anything like it. They're going, you'll be fine. No, no, let's not worry about rehearsing. I'm going, okay. I mean, I've been in tricky life situations, so I do know it's only telly. What's the worst that can happen? But my son is watching. Yeah. My friends, I will never hear the end of it. Never mind the rest of a couple of other million people. So, yeah, counts down in the ear, 10, 9, 8. And then they start, and then you're just looking. And then there's that point, and they start doing it behind the camera. And then you know, that down, the camera, there's loads of people there. But it was all right. I think I might, I don't know if I told you this before, sorry if other people have heard this before, but my wife sent me a picture of our lad sitting in front of the telly after about 10, 15 minutes, and apparently he was watching the show, which he never really does, but he turned to my wife and he said, Mummy, it's going really well, Daddy hasn't said anything stupid yet. And I thought, okay, I'm all right then, I'll be okay. That was the main thing, not humiliating my lad.
So once you got over those nerves and everything was fine, and there were also some recorded pieces that you went out and did there, what did you find was most striking in terms of the change or potential change in that region?
Goodness. So, yeah, we filmed... there's the live element for those of you quite forgivably haven't watched it. You've got better things to do. Travelling, for a start. So there's the live bits where we were properly broadcasting live, and then we pre-shot videos from around the Arctic region to try and give, I suppose, a little bit of a snapshot of life in the frozen north, really. And I went to northern Russia, I went to Greenland, I went to northern Norway. I know as I'm saying it, I feel very fortunate to have done this. So don't worry, I do know how lucky I am. But the extraordinary part of the world, it's being twice as affected by our changing planet and our changing climate as the rest of the world is. The Arctic is being hit very, very badly by our warming world. And we are seeing that. They are seeing that up there. And I don't think there should be any doubt about that. The most, where that became starkest for me, I think, was being in Greenland, which, as we know, is vast up the top. I mean, you can't really quite comprehend how vast it is until you go there. But it's enormous, and it's covered by this sheet of ice that is misnamed because it's more like a block or reservoir, more than a mile thick on average. And that is melting off in terrifying ways. And we met up with a team from NASA, for goodness sake, in Greenland, who are studying the melting ice sheet because NASA is worried about it. They're recognizing that this is a fragile planet that we need to protect. So they're not just trying to explore the rest of the universe. They're worried about us actually surviving on this rock long enough to get off it. So that was a very scary moment when American government-funded people who aren't really known for their tree-hugging nature start sort of grabbing you by the elbows and after they've had a drink or two and saying, this is really, really scary, then you realise it really starts to come home. And I've also had a lot of other experiences around the world. I've been blessed on my journeys. I've met a lot of indigenous leaders around the world who know nothing of the global story, the global picture, but tell me their world is changing. And they're scared about it. There's no record about that in their history. They see it happening, and they want me to tell them why and pass on that fact to the outside world. And God, that's a scary realization as well. We were on the... sorry to turn my back here, but we were on the coast of Colombia, in the Sierra Nevada mountains. I don't know if anybody's been there. Filming, traveling around the Caribbean. And I met the indigenous people there who are called the Kogi, who are one of the most spiritual indigenous tribes or communities I've met anywhere in the world. Some people say they might be the model for the people in Avatar, but they are as connected with their natural world as that. And they came, they hadn't allowed anybody outsiders in to where we went. And they turned down Bruce Parry's Tribe series even from visiting, even though his message was a very positive one, because by the time we were filming, they really wanted to tell us, our world is changing, we're big brother, you are little brother, what is little brother doing to our world? And that's a real, oof, goodness me.
It does come through in your programmes, and obviously talking to you about you feeling lucky. Do you sometimes pinch yourself just how lucky you are, particularly given that you didn't actually do that much travelling until you were an adult, did you?
I didn't really do any travelling. I was uninspired and uninspiring, I would say. Pathetic, if I'm being honest. yes, I pinch myself. I was going to say as well that the people I work with, we pinch each other. And without that sounding like an industrial tribunal's in the offering, we do remind ourselves this is a hell of a thing to be doing. And that's even when it's tricky. That's even when we're exhausted. It's even when we're in a tricky, dangerous place sometimes, frankly, as well. Because it's paid for by the licence fee, for goodness sake. We're there for the BBC. That carries a weight with it. And yes, I am from a quite relatively humble background. Nothing annoys me more than being described as yet another public school boy. I am not a public bloody school boy, okay? I went to school in Acton, which isn't far from here. I was totally hopeless at school. I left with basically no qualifications. I was a bit of a dropout and a little bit naughty, in truth. So I left with nothing. I was on the dole for a long time. Sorry if anyone's heard it, but it's worth remembering when people say, oh, I'm never going to make anything. That was me. I thought I didn't have a hope. I had no ideas. I was working in a charity shop on Chiswick High Street. I worked in H. Samuel in Oxford Circus for a day until they sacked me because I took the keys to the safe home. I went for a job as a white van driver on Wembley Park Trading Estate. And I was turned down for the job, even though I was the only person who applied. And he even told me, you are the only person who has applied for this job, but I don't really trust you with my van. I mean, I had to walk home. I didn't have the money for a bus fare. So I know how lucky I am. I really genuinely do. And nobody's more surprised by this gig than I am. I got a job as a postboy, by the way. That was my way out. I got a job as a postboy on the Sunday Times. I sorted the post properly. I can still do it almost muscle memory. I did that for 8 hours a day, and then I sort of volunteered and stayed on later and did some research for people, and then I got some little jobs to do, and by the time I was 19, I was investigating terrorism. I'm truncating a story here, but that's basically it. Yeah.
Another departure, if you like, this year has been TV in
it's
this
2017.
Country.
I don't know if I should point this out.
Oh,
but
sorry. It's been the Big Life Fix, is based in this country. Mm. How did you get that gig?
So I was asked to do it, or I was asked if I'd do it. I mean, there is a slight cab rank set up sometimes at the BBC where you're available, it's a good job, come on, a little bit, but they ask you as well. There's a process of discussion. So I did a series called Big Life Fix, which those who didn't see, it was not travel at all except for being on branch lines to Wales and things like that. But it was a group of brilliant, incredible boffins building sometimes transformational stuff for people with really chronic, tricky conditions or in tricky situations. So, for example, Emma, who I just showed you a picture. I saw Emma and another James, who was in the programme, saw them yesterday, just for a quick catch-up. But Emma is a young woman with Parkinson's, terrible tremors, and an incredible, slightly in love with her, a designer and scientist called Hyann built a wrist-worn vibrating device that the moment it was put on Emma's hand, Emma was able to draw a straight line and write her name in a way she hadn't been able to do in years.
She's a graphic designer, isn't she?
It was incredible. So writing isn't just useful, it's an extension and expression of her. It's her job, it's her life, she draws, and she can't. And now, it's extraordinary, she can. I mean, it was just one of the standout moments for me of adult life, frankly, being there at that moment. It really felt extraordinary. And I've had that experience on my travels, and that is what keeps me travelling, if you like, for those moments, as we all do, when you have an interaction with someone or a place, or you see something, you experience something, that is just mind-blowing. But yeah, with Emma at that moment, that was. But I was asked to do it, and frankly, they really didn't need me. I think they got me to do it because they thought I'd bring... I was supposed to bring a bit of heart to it because they thought the boffins would be a bit boffiny, and they weren't. They were all they spoke human, and they emoted. They had massive hearts, an incredible bunch. Yeah. I'm in awe of all of them. So I was a bit irrelevant, frankly, but the team and the project was incredible.
If you haven't seen it, have a look on iPlayer. Because it's on there.
Yeah, you can still see
there.
Clips
yeah.
from it, actually. Yeah. The clips have gone viral. Sorry to be very new media-y, but when you think how people watch TV now, it's interesting because, you know, a couple of million will watch a show on the telly, but I think 40 million, when I checked months ago, 40 million had watched the clip of Emma getting her watch. Go on, it fills your heart with a bit of joy. Makes you have some hope for us, I think. So it's worth looking at.
Good. Right, let's get the microphone out. And I'm sure there are questions in the audience. So stick up your hand.
You don't have to. I mean, we can just head off and wander around for inspiration. All right, we're off.
Any questions about practicalities or perhaps places where Simon's
Roddy's
been that
running.
You're thinking of going?
Hi.
Hello.
You said that you were going to go somewhere else in the near future and you were going to do a new series. What's that about?
Thank you for the question. It wasn't planted, but it's appreciated. I'm still getting gigs, to my amazement. So I've just been filming... Well, I was filming at the end of last year in Turkey. So the next thing that probably goes on the telly will be a series called Turkey. And then I've just been filming just now in Colombia. I got back a couple of days from filming in Colombia. Might have forgotten to mention that, sorry. But that was travelling all the way around. We put in some miles around the country, we really did. Really critical time in that country's history as well. Peace process underway, hopefully bringing an end to decades of conflict. It's the world is an extraordinary place, as we all know, but that is not visited by a lot of outsiders. So you want somewhere special to go to, somewhere beautiful, somewhere memorable at a really interesting time, I'd head there, frankly. So we were up in Cartagena, which probably a few of you have been to, but not that many, because only about 50,000 Brits go there each year compared to, 2.5 million go to Turkey, for some context. But incredible place, really amazing time. Hopefully things will be okay there. Next, I'm going off to Russia. I'm going to film a series in Russia. Big events happening there this year, as you know. Big anniversary, rather in the news. How on earth we're supposed to incorporate Russia into one teleseries, but that's the nature of the job, really. So Russia for me, cold places, warm places, extraordinary places, hopefully a bit of wonder about the place as well. Generally, in what I've done, I've spent a lot of time in the tropics, a lot of time in places that we think of as being sunny and glorious, and into those journeys we've fed darker stories, I suppose, to try and give a proper balanced reality of the place. So in Russia, I think we'll probably, which a lot of people think of as being quite dark at the moment, I think we'll try and feed some light. And you know, Russia is, I've been once or twice, and you do meet some crazy, wonderful, eccentric types there. And once you break that hard outer shell, there's a lot of warmth there and shared culture and values. So I'm pretty excited about it. I've got to get some proper kit, though, because we're going to start when it's cold and it will get warmer during the journey. Thank you for the question. We'll do three trips each 3 weeks to a month in length because the distances are just crazy. So in some ways it sounds mad. 3 weeks for 1 hour of television, it's quite obscene in some ways, but hopefully the quantity provides a small modicum of quality. That is the idea. But yeah, thank you.
Question here. Okay.
Hello. If you were to take your wife on a second honeymoon, where would you take her?
Oh, if I was to take her on a first honeymoon, if she was to take me, we actually didn't really have a honeymoon, in truth. So where would I go? Well, we've now sort of legalized the marriage with a child, so he'd need to come as well. So He definitely needs to be factored in. In truth, I think partly because you say honeymoon. All right, now, so I've got there's an explanation here. I would probably say the Maldives. Now, the big part of the reason, apart from the fact that when you're from Acton, as I am, the Maldives is just about the most beautiful place on this planet, frankly. And when I was growing up, I had a poster of Whitney Houston on the wall, and I had a picture of a sort of incredible tropical beach on my ceiling, sort of counter 70s grey London. And I found that, not the exact one, but pretty close in the Maldives. It's spectacular. It's also much more interesting, I think, as a place than many people realise. And we were talking about it just before, or I happened to mention it to some other folk who are here, and I was saying how it's not just a honeymoon destination. You know, places get a bit of a reputation, but actually everywhere is fascinating if you go with your eyes open, you ask questions, you go and see where local people live, what they eat, how they exist, their culture, their faith, etc. The other thing that's brilliant about the Maldives that I don't think they promote enough is that it is a massive marine protected area and reserve. It's one of the largest in the world, actually. And for those of you who are divers, you'll know, and those of you who aren't need to be, life in the ocean gravitates to what's unusual. So you put an anchor, you know, a chain in the ocean, and fish start gathering around it. You put islands in the sea, and fish come from all across the Indian Ocean. It's like an oasis that they gather at. So it's an incredible place. And I have been filming there very briefly, I hasten to add, filming in the Maldives underwater at a moment when 12 enormous mantas came flying through the water towards me, stacked in perfect formation, mouths open, filter feeding. That really takes me back to it, hair on the arms going up. Such a moment in life to be there at that time. And there were other visitors and travellers there. We were sort of trying to push them out of the way. We're filming. I don't care. I want to get a shot, you know. So it was an incredible place to be. And if you do it right and you don't just sit by the pool and you get out, you can have an incredibly memorable time there. So I'd probably choose that if we were gonna splash out. Thank you for reminding me of that duty that I'm at some point. I mean, generally and genuinely, I would really say, though, wherever you're going, don't spend too long sitting by the swimming pool, because life is just too short, and you can top up the tan when you get back, you know? You get the real experiences from getting out, drinking some crazy local drink, trying some mad local food, you know, doing stuff that's a bit out of your comfort zone that you will remember as a result. You know this, that's why you're here. But go further and try different experiences. Sorry.
Got a question there? No? Okay. There was a question. No, we're going to make you run, Roddy, over the lady with her hand up at the back.
You really don't have to, mate, honestly. We can just... Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
My question is, what would you say to the people that are quite anxious about going to Turkey at the minute?
It's a really good question. I'd say go, fundamentally. I'd say you just can't live life on your knees for whatever the concern is. And I think, what would I say? I would say that for me, genuinely, I'm trying to be sincere here, which is hard as a tele presenter, obviously. But it's a realisation for me since I started travelling a lot, which is generally through telly, is the world is much safer than we think. So basic safety things, which I've said before, sorry if you've heard it before, seatbelt, very important. Don't eat the salad, that's probably a bit dodgy. But anything that's been cooked properly, anywhere you feel safe, you probably are. You know, we've had terror attacks, if that's the worry. We've had them here. We've had them in Paris. You know, we've had them in this part of the world. I think if your concern is the political situation, that's completely justified. But if you're going there and you're putting money into local hotels and eating in local restaurants, you are putting money into a local community, and that's something profound and important and valuable that we do when we're on our journeys. So fundamentally, I would say, for goodness sake, go. Travel with your eyes and mind open. Ask difficult questions, because if you do it politely and relatively innocently, you will get away with it, and you will learn stuff. You can use your senses. I think we don't use that enough. We don't use our common sense. Wandering around dark streets at night, not ideal anywhere, is it? You know, in Basingstoke or anywhere else. But Yeah, I think Turkey's an extraordinary country with a very rich history, and we've turned away from it for reasons that aren't entirely rational, frankly, because you don't see political crisis there. You don't. That was a surprise to us. You don't see the war. That was upsetting for us in some way. Right on the border. I was right on the border between Syria and Turkey. I was touching the wall. I could hear the thump of artillery hitting Aleppo to the south. And where I was, there were farmers ploughing the fields on the Turkish side, because that's the nature of our world, that madness exists just a line in the sand from normality. You know, it's mad that the Seychelles are just off the coast of Somalia, for goodness sake. You know, beauty and catastrophe at the same time. So you don't be frightened of what's out there. For God's sake, go, because life is short, you know, basically.
It's a very patient thank lady
you,
at Mama,
the back.
Thank
you, Mama, whoever that was.
Yeah, thank you. Simon, when you were filming Greece, I really felt touched by your raw emotions with the arrivals of people on the beaches and what was left behind. And I just wonder if you've experienced some similar emotions elsewhere that you've travelled to. Thank you.
So thank you for that. So, hearing about being asked questions about my travel, it reminds me of how lucky I am to have done this, honestly. So I made a series about Greece as well that was on last year, and we were in Greece on Lesbos, it was, just as boatload after boatload of migrants and refugees were arriving, and it was a mind-blowing, mind-altering sort of situation. And I met countless people with extraordinary stories, and I sobbed and they sobbed, and here we are in Europe and it's so complicated, and I feel very conflicted by it, because I'm actually not somebody who thinks that everybody going on the move is a brilliant idea in terms of migration. I worry about the brightest and the best leaving countries that are struggling and those countries never actually getting off their feet as a result. So I've met a lot of educated Afghans or Haitians who have naturally, understandably left. But when they go, how does the country survive and grow? 90%, some say 95% of university-educated Haitians have left. You can't build a country without those people there to be part of the fabric of society. So I feel very conflicted by that, the migration story and issue. Yes, goodness me, I have sobbed and cried on these journeys generally. I'm a complete emotional wreck from these experiences. And I think that's still important that I am, that I haven't been so hardened that I don't feel it. And part of the job is to arrive somewhere, get people's stories, leech off them in some ways, frankly, and then take those stories and show them elsewhere. And that's tricky and questionable in some ways. So I've cried at a lot of people's stories. I cried at that story, as you say. That was very touching, because it's raw human situations. And I suppose in some ways what I felt was very good for them as a family, which is obviously getting out of conflict, wasn't necessarily good for those who are left behind, which is often the old and the weak and the sick who cannot make it across a sea that costs a fortune to cross, and the country that is left in tatters as well as a result. So I think what I would say about that specific situation is it's much more complicated than either side, pro-migration or anti-migration, make us realise. It's tricky, but so many things are. Thanks for that.
We've got time for one more question. Let's go there and make it a quick one, if we may.
Okay, sorry.
No, Simon, in your programme on the Indian Ocean, you mentioned the number of attacks by the pirates, and I know that was in 2012. Do you think that's still prevalent?
Thank you for that. No, it's not. It's been dramatically reduced, partly by patrols, partly by... you'd call it nation building, really, state building that's been going on in Somalia, and partly because they've put armed guards on some of the ships, and that's obviously dissuaded pirates. What a situation that was. We actually went on an Italian cargo ship that was going up the coast of East Africa on that series, And their sort of security precautions seemed to be turning their lights off at night and switching off their transponder, so nobody would know where they were, and they wouldn't know where another ship was. But the sort of Italian crew went, "Oh, it'll be fine, don't worry." They had barbed wire down the sides and water pistols, effectively, and that was it. I thought they were mad. But another thing that's happened is Somaliland, which is an unrecognised but functioning country in the Horn of Africa, has also helped to impose controls there, which takes me into a whole other story that you'll have to look up separately, but about unrecognised countries, which I did a series about years ago. Not many people watched it, but I loved it. And that was all about countries that aren't officially countries. So Somalia is still in a pretty bad way. It's improving. But unrecognised countries, Somaliland, Transnistria, South Ossetia, I was talking with somebody beforehand, all you hard and tough travellers, you have a look on unpo.org, and that's like a sort of sub-United Nations for really, really interesting places in the world. All of them fascinating to visit, so I really recommend you look them up. Somaliland's an incredible place to go in a really tricky part of the world. Traffic lights, Minister for Tourism, women in Parliament, democracy, hotels, oldest Neolithic rock paintings in Africa. I'm a sort of a bit of an ambassador for the place. Loved it. One of my favourite places in the world. I'll stop, sorry.
Well, no, fantastic. You have so many favourite places in the world.
It's true, I do. It's an absolute joy, hasn't it, to
listen to. Ladies and gentlemen, Simon's going to be over at the Stanford's stand signing, so carry on the conversation over there.
Thank you for the great questions.
Join me with a great big round of applause. Simon Reeve.
Thank you. Thank you so much.